Today is Monday, March 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Sunday, South Korea took action to try and stop the spread of the coronavirus.
Pews were empty, churches shuttered, and worshippers turned away.
Plus, we break down the deal brokered between the United States and the Taliban.
If all goes well and if all sides meet their obligations, the U.S. will withdraw the rest of its forces.
And after winning in South Carolina this weekend, former Vice President Joe Biden finds his campaign charging ahead of Super Tuesday. Those stories and more next. Many churches were closed in South Korea Sunday, with several holding online services instead, as authorities fought to rein in public gatherings as 586 new coronavirus infections took the tally there to 3,736. VOA's Bill Gallo is in Seoul, and I spoke to him about the closures.
So what you saw here on Sunday was that many churches across the country were closed. That was particularly the case in Daegu, the worst-hit area. In Seoul, some churches did hold services, but many, of course, the biggest ones, including churches like the very famous Yeouido Full Gospel Church, did not have services. Instead, they had YouTube services that their members could watch online. Authorities have urged people not to meet in settings like protests or church services or big gatherings. But nonetheless, some people do continue to do that here, even though those gatherings have been greatly scaled back.
Now, you mentioned Daegu, a lot of churches being opting not to hold services down there. And Daegu is the epicenter of the outbreak in South Korea. Can you kind of walk our listeners through the new reporting out of South Korea that the Seoul government is recommending that the prosecutors investigate Lee Man-hee, the leader of Sincheonji, the church that had people in Wuhan that then came back?
Sure. Now, this is a religious group that, as you mentioned, that has been at the heart of the outbreak here in South Korea. They've been under intense public scrutiny and criticism. They are a fringe group. Many people would call them a cult. Of course, they don't like that label. Now, they have been accused of not properly handling this and not being transparent enough about its members who are infected. Like many religious groups, there are aspects of this group which tend to be secretive, maybe not completely transparent to the public. So this has generated a lot of public anger. The Seoul city government in particular has put out very many critical statements of this group. And last night, in fact, the Seoul metropolitan government asked the prosecution for an investigation into this leader that you mentioned, and then 12 heads of this group's branches for alleged homicide and violating of regulations on preventing infections. It's not clear that prosecutors will actually investigate, and it's much less clear that they would actually even charge this group with anything. But it just shows the level of public anger directed at this group.
That was VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo. The spread of the coronavirus epidemic also shut down France's Louvre Museum Sunday. The AP's Sarah Bassett has that part of the story.
Employee and union representative André Sacristan says workers fear being contaminated by the museum's flow of international visitors. Some were refusing to work. The shutdown followed a government decision to ban indoor public gatherings of more than 5,000 people. Sacristan says staffers were also worried by visiting museum workers from northern Italy who had come to collect works by Leonardo da Vinci on loan for a major exhibition. The COVID-19 outbreak, which began in central China, has infected more than 87,000 people globally and caused nearly 3,000 deaths. I'm Sarah Bassett.
In all, the WHO, the World Health Organization, lists cases of the COVID-19 coronavirus in at least 58 countries. Cases in China's Hubei province have increased for two consecutive days. The WHO is monitoring that development and working to understand its significance. China has about 92% of all reported COVID-19 cases. On Saturday, the representatives for the United States and the Taliban in Afghanistan signed an agreement aimed to end the most protracted conflict the U.S. has been in. The war, which has lasted for 19 years, has cost more than 100,000 lives and more than $1 trillion. Earlier, I spoke with Aisha Tanzim, VOA Bureau Chief for Afghanistan and Pakistan, to break down the details of the agreement.
So this deal has multiple parts, and the agreement makes it very clear that all parts are interlinked, which means that if one part doesn't happen, the other also doesn't happen. What happens is, in the first 135 days, the U.S. will withdraw its forces from the current level of 13,000 down to 8,600. In return, Taliban have promised that they will break with Al-Qaeda, they will fight the Islamic State, they will not allow any territories that they control to be used for terrorist activities. They have also promised that within 10 days of the signing of the agreement, they will sit down with other Afghan factions, and that includes the government, women's rights activists, you know, the opposition, a representative team of all Afghans, and they will negotiate what the future of Afghanistan looks like. In the next phase, which lasts for 14 months, so 9.5 months after the 135 days, if all goes well and if all sides meet their obligations, the U.S. will withdraw the rest of its forces from Afghanistan, and the deal makes clear that that means all American contractors and all American personnel, and it will vacate all military bases.
What's been the reaction in this really first day since the signing has taken place in Afghanistan?
So the reaction has been hope tempered with fear, and the first sign of speed bumps that everybody expected would be part of the bumpy road ahead, we've already seen them. So President Ghani has announced that he has made no commitments to release thousands of Taliban prisoners. Release of prisoners was going to be a precondition for the Taliban sitting down and negotiating with other Afghans. President Ghani says he has made no commitments, and it is not under the authority of the United States. The prisoners are being held by the Afghan government, and only the Afghan government has the authority to release them. The Taliban do not recognize the Afghan government as a legitimate authority. As far as they're concerned, they've made this deal with the U.S., and the U.S. is responsible for getting their prisoners released. So as all sides said, as the Americans said, as the Qataris, the host country that hosted 18 months of these negotiations, said, as all observers and analysts said, it's a bumpy road ahead. There are going to be lots of roadblocks, and this seems to be the first one.
That was VOA's Aisha Tanzim speaking to me from Doha, Qatar, where the agreement was signed. But what's the overall significance of this deal? Now, for that, I spoke with Tom Spoer, director for the Center for National Defense at the Heritage Foundation.
We've been talking to the Taliban now for years upon years. We have not been able to reach any sort of agreement. They have, for the first time, committed, one, to reducing the violence, a ceasefire, if you will. They don't use those words, but to reduce the violence. They have agreed to renounce any ties to international terrorist outfits like Al-Qaeda and their ilk, and not allow any part of Afghanistan under their control to be used for launching attacks on Americans or any other people of that nature. And they've agreed in principle to talk with the Afghan people, and that gets a little complicated, about entering the political process in Afghanistan. So it's significant. We've come to this point a couple of times in the past. This time we've actually signed an agreement.
So I want to follow up on that difficulty, the road bump, because the Taliban don't officially recognize Ashraf Ghani and the government of Afghanistan. So what is the main stumbling block that you're looking for these individuals to overcome to establish long-lasting peace and stability in Afghanistan, given that the two governments haven't been able to talk in the past?
Yeah, and so that's a problem. And so you can imagine, you know, they say they're going to be talking up in Oslo and negotiating up there. And so if you can imagine a situation where the Afghan government's in one conference room and the Taliban's in another, and somebody is shuttling back and forth because the Taliban refuses to acknowledge the government of Afghanistan, that's a problem. I'd like to think that over time, that obstacle will be overcome, and they will get to the point of direct talks. But for the close-in time, that's going to be something they're just going to have to work through and hopefully work out an agreement.
So given that they still have to work that out, do you foresee problems in Afghanistan with the United States slowly withdrawing during that process?
Well, it really depends on whether the Taliban keeps their promises, their words. They've reduced about reducing violence, about not allowing safe haven to terrorist organizations. We'll have to see. You know, it's the Taliban is far from a united, terribly cohesive organization, so they have their own issues just making sure that all the elements of their organization kind of work in unison. So that's they have their challenges as well.
Stepping back, big picture-wise, with the United States committing to a withdrawal over time, what does that do for the stability in the region?
I think it's helpful. I mean, at least at the initial stages here, for the first 135 days, the United States is talking about reducing its presence from about 13,000 to 8,600 soldiers with our coalition partners, reducing their presence proportionally as well. I don't think that'll have much implications for the region, for example, Pakistan or other places like that. It should look pretty much the same. I think, you know, with America doing this right, we keep our most lethal, our most decisive military elements there the longest. So you can imagine air power staying in place, special operations staying in place. The first things to probably be reduced are our advising and assist forces, which should not change the military correlation of forces in the area that much.
I guess the last question I have for you is this. Given what we know about the situation moving forward, with your expertise, what don't we know that you're aware of and you're watching closely?
Yeah, so we have some problems here. Even the Afghan government and who's in charge of that hasn't been resolved. So that has to get done fairly quickly. This conflict between President Ghani and Executive Abdullah, that they'll have to work through that. Otherwise, there'll be no really central government in Afghanistan to work with. Whether the Taliban comes around and starts to recognize the government in Afghanistan is legitimate, that's a key indicator one way or another whether this is actually going to come to fruition. And then finally for me, does the Taliban keep their word on keeping the violence at a very, very low level or not at all? Again, that could undermine this entire deal very quickly.
And that was the Heritage Foundation's Tom Spoer. And coming up later,
UN-mediated political talks aimed at resolving the crisis in Libya have ended in disarray, with nothing accomplished except an agreement to meet again next month.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers led by Binghamton University in Upper New York State is reporting that they have discovered the remains of the oldest forest in Earth's history. The scientists say their discovery provides evidence that the transition from ancient to modern forests began earlier than thought. What the research team found while going through ancient soil near Cairo, New York, were the remnants of an extensive root system of 385 million-year-old trees. This discovery is said to predate the fossil forest at nearby Gilboa, New York, which formerly held the title of world's oldest forest. The researchers say they found three different tree species within the ancient widespread root system. While seed-bearing plants didn't emerge until some 10 million years later, the trees forming the ancient root system had qualities similar to modern seed plants. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Former U.S. President Joe Biden, Vice President Joe Biden, was the easy winner of South Carolina Democratic primary on Saturday. He now faces an immediate new challenge from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders when 14 states vote Tuesday in party contests across the nation known as Super Tuesday. As states prepare for the big contest, I spoke with VOA's Carolyn Persutti in Dallas, Texas, to get a sense of what's to come.
I've always said that Texas is different, and this year it is no change from other years past. Texas goes their own route. You know, they're known as the Lone Star State for a reason. They were an independent republic way back when. And now they want to set their own pace. I mean, you've always seen Texas as a very conservative state, ultra-conservative, always voting Republican nationally. The big cities definitely vote Democratic in their city contests. But overall, nationally, ever since 1980, when they voted in President Ronald Reagan, they voted Republican. So then here comes along 2020, and everybody's saying, oh, Texas is going to go Democrat. Well, you hear that from some people, and you hear there's no way from other people. Bernie Sanders is leading in the polls, which surprises some people, for a very conservative state to be supporting a Democratic socialist. So I went out among the community. I talked to some voters who voted early, and I said, how can this be in such a red state? How can Bernie be leading the state? And you hear varying reasons. A lot of people love Bernie's Medicare for All, his free colleges. Other people say, I don't think that'll ever come true. I don't know how he's going to pay for it. But the experts think that if Texas is going to change, it probably won't happen with this election. They see it down the road. Hispanics in 2 years will surpass the white population as the majority. They have an influx of Asians coming into Texas. So the diversity here is growing in the state. And with that, the diverse opinions as voters.
Is Texas an open primary state?
It is somewhat. We call it the Texas two-step. So it's a primary state where a candidate has to get 15% of the electorate in order to get delegates. So that's the second step, and that's why we call it the traditional two-step, which is actually a dance here in Texas. And it is an open primary where someone who can go in and register the same day and vote, or you can switch your party affiliation if you want on the day of the voting and then vote as a Democrat or as a Republican.
Oh, that's fascinating. Speaking of Democrats, you mentioned that Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, is leading right now in a lot of the polls. But on Saturday, former Vice President Joe Biden came away with the win in South Carolina. Has that changed at all any of the discussions that you're hearing out there?
Absolutely. And I can tell you that while Bernie Sanders was winning in the polls out here, in other polls, he was neck and neck with Vice President Joe Biden. So coming off that win in South Carolina, we expect him to get a boost here in Texas. And he's already released the fact that since his win in South Carolina on Saturday, the campaign has raised $5 million in 24 hours. So that just shows you what kind of a boost a candidate can get by winning one state.
So, Carolyn, while you were in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, you actually went to the Fort Worth Stockyards. Who did you talk to out there, and what did they say?
The Stockyards are amazing just because they hold so much history. I mean, we watched a cattle drive go down the main street. And, you know, you might think of a cattle drive as being quick. Well, these cattle kind of meander down the street. And that's what they say. Texas is very slow-paced, very easygoing, kind of laid back. But then we went to the rodeo where everything happened very quickly. And I talked to a lot of Republicans there, and they said, no way. No way is this state ever going to vote Democrat. One person even went so far as to say to me that he would move out of the state if it went Democrat. Although one lady that I talked to, she had red on, she had a red hat on, a cowboy hat. She said, you know, I can only tell you that if former mayor, New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg wins the Democratic nomination, it's going to be a toss-up for me. And she's a Republican. So it's interesting that the Republicans may be kind of deciding which way they're going to go, depending on who the nominee is. Well, at least here in Texas.
That was VOA's Carolyn Pursuti speaking to me from Dallas, Texas. Now, ahead of Super Tuesday, the campaign trail has claimed two more, with Tom Steyer and Pete Buttigieg announcing that they have suspended their efforts for the White House. Israelis head to the polls on Monday, hoping to break the country's political deadlock. Reuters' David Doyle has this look ahead.
There'll be a sense of deja vu for Israeli voters on Monday as they head to the polls for the third time in a year. So why have there been so many elections? Rewind to 2018, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was about to become Israel's longest-serving leader. But the head of the right-wing Likud party had a precarious one-seat majority and called a snap election for April 2019. The immediate reason given was the vulnerability of his ruling coalition after the resignation of his defense minister. But many saw it as a ploy to gain a renewed public mandate and ward off prosecutors who were then in the final stages of drafting charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust against him. But his plan backfired. Netanyahu claimed victory, but he didn't win enough seats. He then struggled for weeks to put together a government before triggering another election for September. Rather that than give the chance to form a government to his rival, Benny Gantz.
Time has come when the majority takes care of everybody and not minority who takes care of one person.
The second election, Likud and Gantz's centrist blue and white party in a virtual tie. With no outcome after months of horse trading, the jaded Israeli electorate was called back to the voting booths again. But is it any different this time? Well, yes. Formal charges have now been filed against Netanyahu. His trial begins 2 weeks after the election. And both previous elections were fought before details of US President Donald Trump's Middle East peace plan were released. Published in January, it would grant US recognition to Israel's settlements in the occupied West Bank. Netanyahu has pledged to annex the settlements after the election.
We will not stop claiming every single inch of this land when Netanyahu, please God, is being elected.
Opinion polls show Likud and blue and white virtually neck and neck again, though Netanyahu's party edged slightly ahead in the final stages of campaigning. If Monday's vote prolongs the deadlock, a fourth election could be called. Though some Israeli politicians regard this as unacceptable, and it would mean further fiscal paralysis for the country under a caretaker government.
That was Reuters reporter David Doyle. United Nations mediated political talks aimed at resolving the crisis in Libya have ended in disarray, with nothing accomplished except an agreement to meet again next month. Lisa Schlein has more.
The talks got off to a shambolic start. Before the first round of Libyan political negotiations even began, members of opposition warring groups suspended their participation. UN envoy to Libya, Hassan Salameh, acknowledges that caught him off guard.
We were surprised the day the meeting was supposed to start that some people had to leave because they were asked to. However, those who stayed decided that the occasion was too rare and precious, and therefore that the political track should start with those who stayed in Geneva.
Libya has been in a state of crisis ever since rebel military commander Khalifa Haftar attacked Tripoli last April. The military assault on the capital and seat of the internationally recognized Government of National Accord has killed more than 1,000 people and displaced hundreds of thousands. The UN has been pursuing three parallel negotiations. The resolution of Libya's crisis hangs on the continuation and outcome of those military, economic, and political tracks. Salameh says the economic financial track is going well. But the military track is in trouble because the warring parties continue to violate a temporary ceasefire. That, he says, is having a serious effect on the political negotiations. During the past week, he says many areas have been hit by shelling, including the Tripoli airport.
Many areas of the capital have been also shelled. It is clear that neither one of the three tracks can move positively while the cannon is doing what it is doing right now.
Salameh is calling on the two sides to respect the truce they had accepted last month during a summit in Berlin. He also is calling on countries of influence, including those that are intervening in Libyan affairs, to put pressure on those that violate the ceasefire and on those that violate the UN arms embargo on Libya. A United Nations report names Jordan, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates as chief offenders. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As tensions continue to simmer between Turkey and Russia in the north of Syria, Ankara says 34 of its soldiers have died in recent days. Turkey also claims to have killed a large number of Syrian government forces and destroyed Syrian government military vehicles and a chemical weapons factory. Some reports also say close to 10 Hezbollah militiamen were also killed by a Turkish drone strike. Edward Uranian has those details.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on Russia to get out of Turkey's way in Syria and allow it to deal with President Bashar al-Assad in a speech to supporters Saturday. Turkey, he said, has entered Syria at the demand of the Syrian people and not at the demand of Assad. Erdogan added that Turkey has retaliated against Syrian forces for killing 34 of its soldiers.
2100'ün üzerinde rejim unsuru.
He claims that Turkish troops have killed more than 2,000 Syrian forces, destroyed 300 of their military vehicles, and bombed a chemical weapons factory east of Aleppo. Syrian state TV denied a chemical weapons factory had been hit, joking that gases from such an attack would have killed several million people in Aleppo if the story were true. Erdogan, who attended a funeral for soldiers killed in Idlib, told mourners that Turkey has been fighting in Syria, Libya, and elsewhere as it has done in the past, and that there will be more soldiers killed in the future. Thousands of refugees gathered Saturday along the Turkish border with Greece had to flee tear gas used by Greek forces to stop them from entering Greek soil. Erdogan said earlier in the day 18,000 refugees had entered Greece and that the number could rise to 25,000 to 30,000. He said Germany must send money to Turkey to deal with its refugee crisis in order to stop the flow. Inside Syria, Russian-backed Syrian government airstrikes continued around Idlib, and Syrian TV asserted it had recaptured the towns of Mansoura, Ziyara, Tal Wasl, and Zeyzun Jadida from Turkish-backed rebel forces, killing a number of them and chasing them to Khan Safra in eastern Idlib. Rami Abdulrahman of the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights claimed that 48 Syrian troops and their allies have been killed in Turkish attacks during the past 24 hours. Arab media reported 8 Hezbollah militiamen were killed in a Turkish drone strike on their headquarters near the town of Sarakib. Al Jazeera TV showed rebel forces in control of Sarakib, as well as a stretch of the strategic M5 highway from Damascus to Aleppo. Damascus had recently celebrated with fanfare the recapture of the last stretch of the highway. Talks between Turkish and Russian military advisors during the past several days apparently have failed to reach a ceasefire. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu told journalists Saturday that President Erdogan will meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin on March 5th. Syrian Ambassador to the UN Bashar al-Jafri told the UN Security Council Friday that Turkey has failed to live up to the Sochi or Astana agreements in which it was expected to rein in rebel forces. Instead, he said, Turkey has transformed its observer post in Idlib into war operations rooms to use against Syrian and Russian forces. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition of The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, thank you very much for joining us. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. Simply point your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.